Events Council. Thank you very much for accepting the responsibility. Case number two, please. The United States versus...
Fudge, go ahead and say it.
Fudge it. At all. All right, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Vincent Jones. I represent appellate Rodney Raines. Your Honors, I'm going to address specifically a couple of issues. The first issue is a procedural one, and that is when Mr. Raines was sentenced, he was sentenced for an enhancement, a two-level enhancement for possessing a gun at the time of his capture. As a fact, you're aware of the fact Mr. Raines escaped from his institution, remained on the lam for a period of time, and was captured in a residence. Found with him at that residence was a gun in the same room that he was hiding in at the time of his capture. Procedurally, the government bears the burden of showing that Mr. Raines possessed the gun at the time of his capture, and that in order for his sentence to be enhanced, that the gun was in fact part of the conspiracy. The fact is that this conspiracy had already ended and that a second crime had been committed. That crime was one of escaping from a penal institution.
We're trying to avoid punishment for the crime is part of the overall conspiracy too, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that goes to the issue of acceptance of responsibility, for
it
sure.
It also goes to the crime itself. It's part of the ongoing part of the crime, trying to escape responsibility. It's part of the continuing problem, isn't it?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. It is part of the continuing problem. However, the conspiracy was one of drug conspiracy. And at the time that Mr. Raines was captured, there were no drugs found. He was not in a home that he owned or resided in. There was no evidence linking him to the gun at all, other than the fact that he and the gun happened to be in the same room. And as a procedural matter, we are arguing, Your Honor, that the government bears the burden initially of demonstrating that the gun actually was possessed by Raines. And then it shifts to Mr. Raines to prove that it was clearly improbable that it was not connected to the crime itself, and therefore he's not entitled to the two-level enhancement. We'd also point out, Your Honor, that the district court erred when it attributed more culpability to Mr. Raines than it did to all the other co-defendants. Mr. Raines received a three-level enhancement of his sentence as being one of a manager, supervisor at a higher level than all the other defendants involved in this case. However, the facts were, and Mr. Raines testified in his sentencing hearing, that they all participated in the transactions, that they sold to each other, that there was not one more important than any other individual. And while he is accepting responsibility for his actions, we don't believe that the facts procedurally showed that Mr. Raines was more culpable than anyone else. Finally, Your Honor, there are a couple of public policy issues that I would like the court to take notice of. In my brief, I've argued extensively that Mr. Raines' sentence was greatly enhanced because his crime was one that involved crack cocaine. The U.S. Sentencing Guidelines have pointed out, and it's a national issue, that crack offenders are sentenced to greater sentences than those that are sentenced after they have been found guilty of possession of powder cocaine. Also, African-American defendants are sentenced at higher degrees than non-African-American sentences. We believe that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, and that disparity is not what the U.S. sentencing guidelines anticipated when it created the sentencing guidelines.
What are you relying on in the shifting the burden on the gun being in his possession? What specifically are you relying on there?
We're relying on U.S. versus Yorkman, Your Honor. In that case, which is distinguishable from the case at bar, that defendant actually was found with a gun and drugs at the same time, all part of the conspiracy. Unlike Mr. Raines, who was found with no drugs, not even with the gun on his person.
You're talking about shifting the burden of proof, as I understood it. Now,
that's correct, Your Honor.
What shifted the burden of proof?
Well, the burden shifts once Mr. Raines, once the government demonstrates that he possessed.
I understand that, but why didn't that happen here?
The government didn't produce evidence demonstrating that Mr. Raines possessed the gun. And as a procedural matter, that is something that we believe they were bound to do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Gregory Dutch, and I'm representing Lamont Gordon in regards to this appeal. We have one issue in front of the Court today, Your Honor. It's a kind of a time-tested issue. And it has to do with relevant conduct for the amount of weights attributable to my client, Lamont Gordon. There are certain facts in this case that I believe are undisputed. As set out by the government and by the pre-sentence investigation report, there was a schematics as far as how this whole operation worked. And at the kind of top of this schematics was a gentleman by the name of Parham. Underneath him were the lieutenants, was Mr. Miller, Mr. Baker, Mr. Davis, and Mr. Raines. Then underneath that, there were some other individuals. And then, of course, how every conspiracy tends to work, Your Honors, is that you have low-level people selling small amounts of crack cocaine. That is my client, Lamont Gordon. There's certain admissions that all of the parties do admit to, and my client does as well, Your Honor. He admits to knowing all of the people in this conspiracy. He does admit that at times when some of the other low-level people would run out of cocaine, he would be able to cover for those customers. That was admitted. He does admit when he talks to the police when he's arrested that he sold about one quarter ounce or so every 3 days. If you take his words, I think that's puffery. I didn't make that as one of my arguments. You know how these are when these people are arrested, Your Honors, but it adds up to 1.3 kilos. That's underneath the 1.5 kilos that would elevate him into the level 38 in which the district court judge sentenced him to. But there are no other facts for Mr. Gordon that sets out any other kind of weights for him. So you look to the proof, you look to the co-defendant's statements that are laid out in my brief. You have one of the lieutenants of Davis in the case.
Didn't he fill in for Davis from time to time?
No, he never filled in for Davis from time to time.
What about when Davis wasn't available?
No, he did not. He indicated that he would sell low-level amounts when, if you look at the schematic.
I'm not talking about levels. Did he fill in for Davis when Davis wasn't able to answer his own cell phone?
He may have had
it's either yes or no, not what he may have.
I don't recall. He may have had access to Davis's cell phone, and he may have spoken to it, but he never purchased any large amounts of cocaine like Davis did, Your Honor.
I didn't ask you that either.
Then your answer would be yes.
All right.
Another Lieutenant Winfield indicated that my client bought from Stacy Miller. Another Lieutenant Baker indicated that he got it from Winfield. In regards to witnesses, there was only one witness, Sylvia Morris, who said that she purchased $20 of rock cocaine once a week from my client for approximately 2 years. This was an extensive investigation, Your Honor. There were wiretaps, there were surveillances, there were hand-to-hand buys. My client was not on any of the wiretaps pertaining to buying or selling of drugs. He was not on the surveillance. There was a small amount of hand-to-hand buy. So the syllogism goes, I believe, according to the district court judge, that she found that there were 30 kilos of cocaine. Therefore, my client sold cocaine. Therefore, he must be responsible for in excess of 1.5 kilos. That was the amount of evidence that she used. And I do not believe that this fits into a joint undertaking. My client did not buy the drugs. He did not share in profits. He did not.
Did he ever answer when he was questioned that he did fill in for other members of the conspiracy?
He did.
When they were dry or they were too busy or they were too lazy?
Yeah, that's the truth.
So he was really involved in helping out the whole conspiracy, wasn't he?
That would be at the low-level end, is that if someone on the bottom rung would not have access to the drugs, then...
No, if they were too lazy or they were too busy or they weren't available. Not that they didn't have access.
There was among the low-level...
Didn't he give that answer himself?
According to the police statement, he gave that answer to himself, yes.
Is it wrong?
I have no evidence to not support that it's right. So, I would agree that it's right. But in general, how does I mean, the question becomes, how does being, if someone else is selling cocaine rocks $20, $40 at a time, and they're too lazy, and he then covers for them occasionally, that still fits into the over amount of the 1.3 kilos that we're talking about. I don't know where in the world one can find out that he has a total amount of 1.5. This was not a joint undertaking. This was like a separate business deal, like someone doing insider trading, where you would have someone who gets some low-level information. He's responsible for the money back to the company that he is responsible for, but not for the chief executive who might have made millions on it. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Morris Berman. I'm appointed to represent Age of Fudge in this appeal. We raised several challenges in this appeal, one of which was to the Title III. There were a couple separate challenges to the Title III interception here. The most significant of those, I believe, the most significant problem with the Title III authorization was with the order itself signed by Judge Shabazz. 2518-4D requires specification of the identity of the person authorizing the application. This order did not name a name. It did not say who had authorized the application. And this, we submit, makes this case more on the Giordano side of problems with the Title III rather than Chavez side. This isn't a case where there was a mere mistake made in naming the person who authorized the application, but there was no specification. In fact, the magistrate judge in his report and recommendation found that there was no specification, although we found that this was on the Chavez side of the line rather than the Giordano type of problem. Nevertheless, we submit this was a critical noncompliance with Title 18, 25, 18, 4D. There was no person named in the district court's order authorizing this intercept. We also raised issues regarding relevant conduct. I submitted extensive objections and also an analysis of what we submitted on behalf of Asia Fudge was her relevant conduct, and it was short of the 1.5 kilograms. This circuit has time and time again, in the Goins case, which I cited in my brief, in the McIntyre case more recently, emphasized the need to make an explicit finding as to quantity, and that the district court should state the reasons why the defendant was aware of or reasonably foresaw a particular amount of drugs. This becomes critical with respect to Aja Fudge because she was not involved during the entire more or less two-year period of time. It also becomes critical because there were some rather high-level people in the case, namely Mitchell Davis and Kenneth Baker, who had separate sources, and you can't necessarily attribute those amounts that Kenneth Baker and Mitchell Davis were obtaining and sort of operating as a subset and dealing those amounts to Asia Fudge. That wasn't within the scope of her agreement, which was with Raines, which was with Davis, but I tried to fairly attribute those amounts to her in my analysis of relevant conduct. It came up short of 1.5 kilograms. The district court never explicitly determined or stated reasons why more than that should have been attributed to Asia Fudge. Finally, there is a third argument regarding the sentences imposed in the Western District of Wisconsin. And this particular issue was joined in by Appellant McChristian, represented by Mr. Anderson. The Western District has become an outlier district. The sentences are massively disparate from sentences imposed in drug cases nationwide. McMurtry, recently decided by this court, said that in terms of disparities, you have to look at things nationwide. I tried to do that. I presented those statistics to the court to Judge Crabb, because the shortcoming in the McMurtry case pointed out by this circuit was that no statistics were presented. That was a shortfall. You had to look at it nationwide. They're 50% to 60% to 70% higher in drug cases in the years I presented. In Mr. McChristian's case, Judge Crabb indicated that the 2001 statistics are going to show something much different. I don't believe they do. We'll have to supplement that by 28J. In fact,
could this be related to the cases that are prosecuted federally in this district?
I'm sorry?
I say, couldn't this be related to what cases are prosecuted in federal court as opposed to some other district?
Well, the way those statistics were broken down for 98, 97, 98, 99, whatever years I presented, was in broad categories, narcotics cases, and not broken down further. But the results are skewed beyond any imagination that it has something particular to do with the cases prosecuted in the Western District. One would have to assume that we have bigger quantities in the Western District than anywhere else to produce those types of disparate results.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you,
Your Honor. All right. Mr. Rodero.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm John Beaudry. I represent the United States, the District Court, and still with the case today. Addressing the issues in the order that the appellants presented them, starting with Mr. Raines, regarding the gun, I think the brief and perhaps his argument today is sort of mixing the metaphor. I think it's very clear that the burden was appropriately assigned by Judge Crabb. The government had the burden.
Judge Crabb at one point said that she found that it was clearly improbable that Mr. Raines had access to this gun. Now, the clearly improbable relates to the other question of whether it was further into the conspiracy. But so I don't know whether she misspoke, or and they haven't really relied on this, but it struck me that she had made this statement in connection with her findings. How do you explain that, or what's your reaction to that?
First of all, I was not aware of that statement. I would have to say, given my understanding of I guess the way the case went in its entirety, and Judge Crabb's usual care, at least, that would most certainly have to be a misstatement, or just she just was mistaken and misused the words. She clearly believed that this was that there had been no showing by the defendant that it was improbable that this was linked to the relevant conduct. And I think for the points that Judge Barr made in his questions, it's very clear. It doesn't have to be linked to the drug conspiracy. It has to be linked to relevant conduct. And there couldn't really be anything clearer that he was trying to avoid responsibility for that offense. I think the real issue, and I think the way I at least perceive it today, is not that the burden was improperly shifted, but I think what Mr. Raines is saying today is that we didn't have sufficient evidence to prove that Judge Crabb clearly erred in finding the possession, leaving aside the link to the offense. That's a factual question, not a legal question. I try and point that out in my brief. And I think the facts are sufficient that this court can find it was not clear error. He's hiding in a basement bedroom. The gun isn't on him, certainly, but it is, it's not hidden like in a closet. It's sitting there. It's visible. It's easily accessible, small room. His cell phone, his little time port thing, is in the room with him. $3,300 is in the room with him. He says he's getting ready to leave. So I think the possession, I think the government did satisfy the burden, and I believe to the extent Judge Crabb said it was clearly improbable that he possessed it, I think I would offer at least that I think what she meant to say is that it was clearly improbable that this was, it was not clearly improbable that this was linked to the offense. As to the other two issues addressed today by Mr. Raines, I'm not quite sure they were all framed up in the brief, but be that as it may, regarding the managerial role, Mr. Raines did receive an additional three-level enhancement for being a manager of at least one person in a criminal conduct involving at least five participants. And other people did not get that enhancement. The structure of this group was such that they really, just, and I'll turn to that in a moment with Mr. Dutch's arguments for Mr. Gordon, it really wasn't truly hierarchical, with the exception of Mr. Raines. As is very clear from the pre-sentence report, Mr. Raines managed Ms. Fudge, his partner, the mother of his child. He, and she said this, the others, all the others say this, if you called and Raines couldn't do it, Raines would tell Fudge to come over. The wiretaps confirm that, and so I think to the extent the issue is framed today, was Judge Crabb clearly erroneous in assessing that three-level enhancement? I think the answer is very emphatically no. Just looking at Ms. Fudge's statements, it's no. Regarding the policy statement, regarding the crack cocaine sentences, again, I'm not so sure that was really framed up in the brief, but I think that issue has been fully ventilated, whether you know, Mr. Raines agrees or not, and he clearly doesn't. The disparate effect on African Americans, the 100-to-1 ratio between powder and crack cocaine, has pretty much been decided, I think, and isn't, I really don't think it's before this court in this case. As to the other issues with Mr. Raines, if there are any questions, I will just rely on what we said in the brief. Regarding Mr. Gordon and Mr. Dutch's arguments, just a couple of points I want to make. First of all, in the reply brief, there's some intimation that the government's arguments and the government's my initial brief were relying on a protected post-arrest proffer. I want to make sure it's very clear that that is nothing could be farther from the truth. Mr. Gordon was arrested on January 22nd, 2001. We did some complaints prior to the indictment. He was arrested along with several other of his co-defendants. He advised his rights. He makes a statement, that I'll discuss in a moment that you discussed with Mr. Dutch. Downstream in May, when we're trying to resolve this case, he does make a proffer that assists in other cases and so on and so forth. I'm not relying on that. It's not set out in our brief because that would be clearly inappropriate. In terms of the argument that he's a low dealer, a low level in this group, first of all, I don't think the group really was set up that way. The chart in the PSR was put together by the PSR writer. It was it really has no effect on the sentence at all. The only question is, was 1.5 kilograms or more reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Gordon? He did not get any bump in his guidelines for role in the offense. He also did not get a minimal role, and there's really no argument about that. He pleaded to the conspiracy charge. But I think most importantly, and this goes back to Judge Coffey's questions, his own words answer the question, was the other conduct reasonably foreseeable? When he's arrested on January 22nd, he describes his own dealing, which adds up to, I do the math and we all kind of estimated it a certain way, about 1.3 kilograms, just on his own. He says he's been in Madison 1.5 to 2 years, he's dealing about a quarter ounce of crack every 2 to 3 days. That's what he does. But then what he says is that he had 10 customers of his own, and as Judge Coffey pointed out, I covered for the other stone. Those are the people on this little chart. We had a photo chart that we showed the arrestees, and that's what's mentioned in the PSR. He covers for the other stones, meaning the pea stones, when they send customers because they're dry, busy, or lazy. That shows reasonable foreseeability. Add to that, in the record, in the PSR, which is docket number 256, and my notes are right here, paragraph 58G, he says that he answered the phones for Davis and Daniels specifically and made their deals when they couldn't do it. So right now you take the 1.3 kilograms that he personally dealt to these 10 customers whom he identified, not by name, but who he said he had, and now you add whatever Davis was moving, whatever Daniels was moving, not that he was involved in all their sales, most certainly, but it was certainly reasonably foreseeable to them. Daniels, he refers to as his brother, and is in one shape or fashion. Clearly, the only question is, was an additional 0.2 kilograms reasonably foreseeable? And I think his own words answer that question quite clearly. Turning to Ms. Fudge and in part Mr. McChristian, first, Ms. Fudge's arguments regarding the wiretap, I'll address the authorizing official argument, which was raised today, and rely on my brief for the exhaustion argument. The authorizing official was identified in the wiretap application, Kevin DeGregory. We attach his memo that says you're good to go, essentially. He was, at the time, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division. The letterhead in the memo says Criminal Division, and he signs on as the Deputy Assistant. That's attached to our application. I will certainly concede that in Judge Shabazz's order, it does not specifically say, pursuant to an application authorized on May 5th by Kevin DeGregory of the Criminal Division. It says it's authorized, the order is issued pursuant to an authorized application. I think we take the word hyper-technical to a new extreme if we then say, well, Judge Shabazz must have meant or didn't know or so on. Obviously, he had the application. The guy's name is there, the memo's there, and that I believe, is sufficient. Regarding the drug amounts, second to the last issue, from Ms. Fudge, as Mr. Berman, I think, pointed out today and has pointed out in the sentencing transcript, at sentencing, she, Ms. Fudge, and Mr. Berman conceded that she was involved in about 1.4 kilograms of cocaine. Essentially, just her. The argument being that other things weren't reasonably foreseeable, and what Judge Crabb really needed to find is all, given that concession, was another 100 grams. And it is at this point that the bean counting and the guidelines is perhaps demeans the process and what it means to everybody involved, but that's the system we have. If one looks at the PSR, which I discuss at length in the we talk about in the briefs, there are individuals who talk about, co-defendants who talk about getting crack cocaine specifically from Ms. Fudge. They also talk about getting it from Mr. Raines, but that's another point I'll make in a moment. Mr. Gordon, Mr. Winfield, Mr. Baker, Mr. Daniels all talk about dealing with Raines and specifically dealing with Fudge as part of that that setup. Just taking what they say about their dealings with Ms. Fudge is approximately a little bit over, let's say, 1,500 grams, about what Mr. Berman and Ms. Fudge conceded. But in terms of reasonable foreseeability, all of them say, I dealt with Mr. Raines, and when Ms. Fudge would pitch in, and he wasn't there, so on, if I called, she'd answer. The wiretaps confirm that. There's a series of phone calls, specifically in May of 2000 when we ran the wiretap, where Mr. Winfield's trying to clear up a large amount of crack cocaine. He's talking to Raines. Raines says, I'll send Fudge. The next call is, why isn't she here yet? Four or five calls in the span of about 5 minutes that perfectly depict the relationship between Winfield, Raines, and Fudge at a bare minimum. Given that, given the statements that they dealt with Fudge and Raines, one, it's inescapable, I think, and unavoidable that when Judge Crabb adopted the pre-sentence calculations, she adopted the conclusion that what these other fellows were doing was certainly foreseeable to Ms. Fudge. She was not just dealing one-on-one with these individuals. Her partner, her manager, her supervisor, if you will, Mr. Raines, was also dealing with them extensively over just that one-year period that she was involved. Clearly moves it up over another 100 grams. Just with Mr. Daniels alone, it was 26 times over a year at a quarter ounce each time. Mr. Winfield, it was another 15 to 20 times, and so on. Finally, turning to the argument that Judge Crabb erred in her decision not to depart downward. First of all, I want to go back to what I said in the brief. I don't think this court has jurisdiction over the issue. I know Mr. Berman in his reply brief said that the government, by raising that, is just trying to take the easy way out and avoid these horrible statistics. First of all, I don't think they're horrible. Let's start with that. Second of all, we're not trying to take the easy way out. I don't like to stand in front of this court and certain panels and have them say, well, wait a minute, why'd you address it on the merits when it clearly shouldn't even be before this court? I don't think the court has jurisdiction. Judge Crabb never said, gee, I really wish I could depart, but I can't. She never said, look, I don't have authority to do what you're asking me to do. She knows how to say those words. She didn't say them. She debated the meaningfulness of the statistics. Excuse me, and then she just said she's not departing. I think that's the end of the argument. Assuming that it isn't, and we turn to the merits, I respectfully have to disagree with the meaningfulness of the statistics that Mr. Berman has put forward. First of all, in terms of disparity, what the guidelines talk about, and Judge Crabb pointed out, avoiding disparity between defendants with similar records at the top of the chart and similar conduct, the vertical axis of the guideline grid. The fact that defendants get longer sentences, and it appears to be statistically true in the Western District of Wisconsin and other districts, is the only argument made here for departure. It is, I think, a meaningless statistic. Those cases can, and many of them are, and today's a good example. They're appealed. Judge Crabb and Judge Shabazz make guidelines decisions. If the cases aren't appealed, the sentence stands. If they're appealed, this court reviews the relevant conduct of the sentences. Whatever our statistics end up being, it's either as a result of unappealed cases where the defendant agrees they're okay, I guess, or the Seventh Circuit either after remand or just affirming the conviction. Those sentences stand as lawful sentences. So the fact that in another district, perhaps the U.S. Attorney, perhaps judges in other circuits, you know, say, well, it's a kilo, but that's kind of a long sentence. Let's call it an ounce. I don't know how these things happen. But it would appear from the sentences that there aren't a lot of departures for other reasons, willy-nilly in our district. The judges follow the guidelines. Judge Crabb, as she said in this case and has said many, many times, is, to put it mildly, no fan of the guidelines, but she's a judge and she follows them. And I think one other fact, just in defense of our humble district, we're a small, relatively rural district. When you get a series of cases like just this case with what ended up being 12 people and a few more convicted, 11 in this case, Mr. Raines has a life sentence. There's another fellow, Stacy Miller, I'll be arguing in a couple weeks, has 440 months, I think. That takes, when you're talking about a relatively small number of cases, it's pretty easy for that average to shoot through the roof, where it might not happen in the Northern District of Illinois or Miami or places like that. We don't do a lot of small marijuana cases for various reasons. Maybe that'll change. You never know. But our numbers, if they're skewed, they're skewed because of essentially the set that we're dealing with, not because of some illegality or impermissible disparity. Well, that's my defense of the district. And if there are any other questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Do you have any further? All right.
Okay.